This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News. You already knew that. Joined, as I am every week, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris. Did a little wave there to the CBSN audience. He's the political director of CBS News. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
First things first, folks. In the ever-expanding world of podcast cross-pollinization, I want to thank the good chaps at Men in Blazers. They had me as their guest when they brought their podcast here to Washington last week for their show talking about the dawning of the new English Premier League season. I was a guest at the British Embassy along with the Ambassador Kim Derrick. That was a great, great time. The Guinness was exactly the right temperature. And I quoted a little bit of Shakespeare, Richard II, Act 2, Scene 1. Check my Twitter feed if you want to see that dramatic rendition of Shakespeare, ladies and gentlemen. Now that that's out of the way, so last week, you remember, we had William Cohen. And we had a conversation after the show, and he said, you know what? The next person we need to have on this podcast, at the Takeout Podcast microphone, is Janet Langhart Cohen, married to Bill Cohen. Why? Because she is an author, a playwright, a distinguished broadcast journalist, an activist in American political life, and she's a fascinating conversationalist. So Janet Langhart Cohen, welcome to the Takeout Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Major. You too, Steve.
We're
hello
so
to
great
Boston.
To have you.
You think Boston's listening?
I hope so.
Boston is always listening, and so is Chicago, where, if I'm not mistaken, that's where you got your earliest start in broadcast journalism.
Major,
correct?
That is exactly right. It was at CBS. So here's
WBBM,
the big family.
Right? WBBM, right?
WBBM. I was the weather girl, and then it was all right to call us girls.
And that was your title, the weather girl.
The weather girl. Mm. And it began my career, and from there I went on to Boston.
Mm-hmm. And when was that? Give us the Wayback Machine. What years are we talking about?
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a friend of mine, and he was a mentor. And as you all know, he was murdered. He was assassinated in 68. And right after that, I think the country had somewhat of a conscience about race. And doors began to open in places they hadn't been open for minorities before. And I had been modeling for the local retail stores, Marshall Field, Carson Perry Scott, and was seen in newspapers. And one day I got a call. This would have been in 1969, 70. I got a call from my agent who said, they're looking for someone to be a weather girl at CBS. I said, I know nothing about the weather, meteorology. I can't even pronounce it. She said, just go over there. I found out that I got the job because I was the last person they saw. The last person is the one who's remembered. And I think they were looking to change things at CBS. CBS has always been very progressive. And I got the job. And it was a wonderful experience. I had it for 3.5 years.
So let's pull a couple of threads of what you just said. You were a friend of or an associate of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. How did that start? And what was it like, as I imagine you were a very young person, modeling as an African-American woman in America in the late 60s, early 70s?
Yes, I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana, and I don't mind telling my age. I don't have a choice anymore with Google. But I was born...
None of us do.
I was born
especially
in...
Especially this week for me. Look it up, folks.
Are you having a birthday?
On Thursday.
Happy
it's my Sammy
birthday.
Hagar birthday, 55.
55, you're just
only
beginning. I have
seriously.
I have 20 years over you.
Excellent. And you don't
I was born, nice. Thank you. Yeah. I was fishing.
He looks 20 years older than you.
No, he doesn't. He's handsome. So are you.
So are you, Shaq Garris. You're so handsome.
No, I was born in 1941, and the reason I'm sharing that is because, as we know about our American history, that was apartheid America. It was segregated America. And even though I lived in Indianapolis, which is called Up South, there were still race rules. So with the segregation and all, it kind of shaped me. And I remember being a fan or being someone who wanted to meet Malcolm X, but sadly he too was assassinated before I moved to Chicago. And when I did move there for a modeling job, there was a rally on the west side of Chicago on freedom rights. Dr. King was appearing. As you know, he moved there one summer, even with his children. So I went there, and in this big place, it was a belly-to-belly event. I saw this tall, dark, handsome man standing up in the distance. And to my escort, I said, look, there's Sidney Poitier. introduced me. So we rambled through the crowd, and I had a Coca-Cola in my hand, and somebody hit my arm, and it spilled on someone. And when the Coke spilled, all of a sudden, it was like everybody ganged on me. And I looked around and then looked to my side, and the man that I had spilt the Coke on was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so in an effort to meet Sidney Poitier, I met Dr. King. And later, I was staying with Mahalia Jackson, who was a great gospel singer of her time back in the 60s. And that was the rallying point for all the civil rights leaders who were in Chicago. Andy Young, Dr. John Thurston, Bernard Lee, Dr. King. And that evening, Dr. King walked in. And I said, oh, no, he's the one I spilled the Coke on.
He's
I was just sorry.
So
well, he wasn't. He already, you know, accepted my apology then. And we got to talking about the civil rights movement. And I told him I wanted to march with them in the South. And I said, why do you let them stone you? Why do you let them call you names? Why do you just pray? And he said, nonviolence is the strategy. And I said, I want to march with you. I'll show those. And I said a few things. And he said, what would you do if they called you nigger? I said, I have some words I can call them. He said, what would you do if they spat on you, if they threw urine on you as they did on us? What would you do? And from the trees, they were throwing urine. I said, they think we can climb trees? I'll be up one of those trees. I remember him sitting back in that chair, putting one leg over the arm of the chair and looking at me because I was sitting at his feet. And he said, child, you can't march with us. He said, if you do what you want to do, you will put a stick in their hand. That's just what they want us to do. They want us to behave that way. He said, nonviolence is not only the right thing to do, it's the strategic thing to do. We stand out because we are black. We are outnumbered because we are black. And they have all the weapons. So that moment changed me. I never really got the turn the other cheek thing, but I did understand their strategy and what courage it took to be in the midst of that racial hatred and to be able to stand there like John Lewis and so many others, like Dr. King, and take that. So when Martin was assassinated, I became more angry and more determined, but I also needed to have a job. So when I was offered this job at CBS, I took it. And I thought it would be the first step to being powerful enough to do what I'm doing now, to speak out against racial justice and not fear that I'd lose my job.
Now, you were a trailblazer. I mean, I guess at WBBM, you were the first African-American woman or man, right? On the news.
Isn't that amazing?
And that was 1970, you said?
That was 1970. I worked there until 73.
And then you went to Boston. Right. And I want to ask you about that, because that was a time in Boston where there was some racial strife. And if I remember correctly, now, 73 is a little before my time, but the late 70s, mm-hmm. there were still, I think, maybe only two black women on television, you and Liz Walker, on doing
the
news.
No, there was Sarah and Shaw. Remember Sarah and Shaw?
Oh, yes.
She was on before Liz. She was on before I was on, actually.
Okay.
I was the first non-white person to do a show that wasn't about minorities in the community. And my show is about talking about anything. 1970s was not Boston's finest hour. There was quarter to busing, and I saw, you have to understand what my mindset was about Boston then. Boston was John Kennedy to me. Boston was Harvard. Boston was the abolitionist. Boston was the Freedom Trail. So to come to Boston as an adult in my 30s and see white women with rosaries in one hand and rocks in the other stoning black children going to school, a cognitive dissonance, I couldn't understand what was going on. I tried to talk to Cardinal Medeiros, and Cardinal Medeiros wouldn't receive me. Word is that Cardinal Medeiros, because he was Portuguese and he was your color and my color, he was not Irish. He wouldn't want to talk about racism. As you remember, he wouldn't bring it up. Kevin White, the mayor, was my dear friend. He had difficulty bringing it up. I went to the Basilica in Roxbury, the Irish Catholic Church in Roxbury, and I talked to Father Joe, who is a wonderful priest, and I asked him, why won't the voice of God in Boston, who represents Rome, speak up against the Catholics who are stoning black children? On one hand, they say we're dumb, we don't want to be educated, and then when we send our children to school, they stone them. And he didn't have an answer. I have to say, having said that, what happened in Boston last weekend. Boston rose to the occasion, and they were strong against racism. They stood up when our president didn't stand up as to what happened in Charlottesville. So yes, that is one Boston. It's like I have another, like I have two Americas. I have the apartheid America that I grew up in, and I have the America of today, of promise. And Boston has two Bostons, and now we're in our finest hour. And I'm proud to say I work there.
Before we go to break, I want to ask you, since you're the arc of your career and the arc of your life has taken you a great distance personally through this evolution in America, would you say, number one, that America has evolved? America is in a different place. Its consciousness is in a different and better place than it was, let's say, in the 60s and 70s. Number one. Number two, what, and this is always, this is the perpetual question, what is left to be accomplished?
I love this country with all of its warts and flaws. And yes, we are in a better situation. It looks dark now. It's a little like the total eclipse of yesterday. It's a little dark before it gets bright again. What happened in Charlottesville is unfortunate, but we have to remember this country's original sin of slavery. And my people were enslaved for more than 300 years. We're not enslaved anymore. We have to remember there used to be signs up, not only just for black people, but for those who were Jewish and those who were Irish. Yes, we have come a long way, and as everyone has said, we have a longer way to go. I love this country also because I have great faith in the Constitution. The ironies of this country that someone like Thomas Jefferson could write the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, with one hand and hold a slave in the other.
And never free them.
But what has survived is the Constitution, and it's working. That's where I have faith, in the American people and the Constitution. The American people, because the more recent rallies, they're mostly whites against hate, against anti-Semitism, against racism. So, yeah, I'm confident.
Excellent. The happy sounds you hear around us, Old Ebbitt Grill, you know if you are a listener, and I know you are, this podcast, one of my longtime favorite restaurants in Washington, and one of my best friends here at Old Ebbitt Grill is our waiter, Fabian. Fabian, it's great to see you. We missed you last time we were here. You were in Alaska on vacation. You do get a vacation every now and again. I'm so glad you did, but I'm very happy to see you, Fabian. Fabian, you know what I love for have at lunch? Trout Parmesan, please.
What Parmesan?
Trout. It's excellent.
Is that Italian?
No. It's, wait till you see it. It's fantastic. Steve Shigaris.
How about Mrs. Cohen?
Can I wait? Maybe I'll have oysters.
Yes, have the oysters. Yes. That'll be great. That's a good visual.
The raw ones. Do you have raw ones?
Oh, what are they ever?
I'm sorry?
12.
I'll just get a Caesar salad with some steak on it. Cook medium. Medium.
Medium plus.
Medium, please.
So, before again, we're going to go to break here in just a second. You love the Constitution. You have faith.
And I also love my country.
Sure. And the events of the last couple of weeks remind you that the struggle continues?
Yes.
Or depress you in any sort of way?
Whenever you see uprisings, you just see anybody packing guns, spewing hate. I thought we had fought and lost those two wars. The first war was the war of northern aggression, if you will, the Civil War. I thought we fought that war, and we won that war. And the war of the Nazis, my father fought in World War II. I thought we won that war. So those enemies are still amongst us. The Confederates, who are seditionists, who were treasonous, which is the contradiction. I don't know how you can be patriotic for this country and be for the Confederates. Mm-hmm. Maybe your mother and father, you know, had something to do with that side. But that's over. The North won. The country won. We won World War II. The Nazi war should be over. And so is it the Confederates, is it the Nazis, or is it something in our DNA that makes us hate? I had a conversation the last time I saw Elie Wiesel, who is one of the more famous survivors of the Holocaust, And I asked Professor, I said, is hate part of the human heart? Is it a part of our DNA to hate? And he said, yes, but it is also part of our DNA to love. And that's what I think we're searching for. I'm reading a wonderful book now by Yuval Noah Harari. He's an Israeli who writes about humanity. It's called Homo Deus. Another previous book, I believe, was Sapiens. And he talks about how we want to explore the solar system and how it works, going to Mars. We need to go inside of ourselves, our humanity, and find out what we need to discover and change and where we need to live. So it's sad that we have these recurrences of hate on the surface. It's even sadder and scarier because they're no longer wearing hoods. Mm-hmm. They're wearing polo shirts. And they're packing. And maybe when you come back from your commercial break, we can talk about how I feel about our military and the statements that our chiefs just made shortly after Charlottesville that our president couldn't make.
That's the voice of Janet Langhart-Cohen. She was a broadcaster for many, many years, so she knows when there's a break, there's usually a commercial. I guarantee you we're working on that, folks. We are really close at the Takeout Podcast to latching on to our first and most cherished commercial sponsor. We're not quite there yet, but we do have a break. And we'll join you right after that. You're listening to The Takeout.
You are listening to The Takeout.
And loving every minute of it, I'm Major Garrett, joined by Steve Shigaris. Janet Langhart-Cohen is our special guest. You know, Janet, we have these Takeout Podcast stickers. They are really glorious. They're signed by me in either red or blue ink. CBS
or black ink sometimes.
Or sometimes black ink.
You just started the blue and red.
That's right. Started the blue and red. I'm just mixing it up.
Sharpie.
Mixing it up. You can have that one. Keep that for your laptop, for your refrigerator, for your many vehicles at the Cohen Estate.
But why the colors?
Well, it's just I pick up the Sharpie, whatever the Sharpie is, and I just start signing away, you know?
How many black ones do you have?
Many, many, many. Much yes. More of those. Much more of those than blue and red. For sure. For sure. I tried gray. Gray does not transit. No, does not work. Steve, how do they, in CBSN land, hello, and in our beautiful and much cherished podcast universe, how do they obtain said sticker?
Well, as our fans know, if you'd like your very own podcast, Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20036. Did
There's
you recognize that music?
70s music for you.
That was your
Where'd
old.
Where'd you get theme. That? I love
Everything's
that.
Online.
It was Feels So Good.
That's the theme song from Good Day, which is the show that that Mrs. Cohen co-hosted, Janet in the mid to late 70s.
In Boston.
Which I grew up watching as a child.
This is our fanboy segment. This is our fanboy
right,
segment.
I have
Go
to
ahead,
say,
Shaggy.
I have such fond memories of you and John Willis hosting that show. You know, you as a kid, you remember certain things on television. That was one show I never forgot. And when you sort of came back into when you came out of the national scene, when you married Secretary Cohen, I was like, I remember her from Good Day as a child watching
Thank
so,
you. How just, old were you then?
Well, let's see. I probably started watching that 5, 6, 7 years old, and you left in 79 but came back.
How could you remember that at 5 and 6, 7
you
years
just,
old?
Look, I have a weird memory when it comes to television. I watched way too much television as a child, but this was one of the things that I never forgot. I just remember the relationship between you and your co-host.
I love John Willis.
And it was so much chemistry, and it was such a great show to watch, and even as a 6 or 7 year old, you knew there was something there.
Well,
so.
He was the voice of reason. And I was the loose cannon. I would say anything.
So just know, Janet, you were there at the formative years of Steve Shigaris'
yes.
broadcast journalism career, and we are thankful to you for that.
You think we inspired you to go into broadcasting?
I think, it was part of it. I think it was part. Channel 5 was a great station. Back
there we go.
This is WCVB in Boston. It's the ABC affiliate. We won't talk about it much anymore since we're CBS.
I've never heard of that network.
But I do want to transition into how you met Secretary Cohen, which is, you know, he was our guest last week, and he suggested
did
that
he
we have you
Did he give
you
his version?
Well,
we did not go into it, actually.
Oh, okay.
I would call the sort of the abridged version of how you met. And then I want to play a soundbite from an interview that you and your husband gave to Charlie Rose a few years back.
Oh.
But go ahead and tell us the quick story about how you met.
Well, you know, you and I have this commonality of Boston, and you were just talking about my being on television there. That's where I met Bill. He was a young congressman who was representing Maine, and it was during Watergate. And he was the lone Republican congressman who voted for the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. And he was very infamous among Republicans, but very famous among everyone else. And our show, Good Day, was seen all over New England. We had the New England Network. So he could reach his constituents through our television show. So he came to Boston to do the show, and John interviewed him because back then, girls weren't allowed to do deep, heavy interviews.
Right,
I could do cooking and celebrities and all that. John interviewed Bill the first time. And when I came out of the studio before Bill had gone in to be interviewed, he was leaning over the water fountain, and then when he looked up, he blew his nose. And he had the worst cold ever. He could hardly talk.
Strong, but, sexy move. Right.
But what really moved me were his eyes. He had the bluest eyes I'd ever seen. And I don't know if it was love at first sight, but I never forgot that image. And then Andy Young was a good friend of mine who had been with Dr. King. And I would call Andy because Andy was serving in Congress, too, in the House. And I asked Andy, what's going on in Washington? Tell me what's going on in Washington Post, because I got to look smart because they won't let girls do heavy interviews. And he said, I have a friend, Bill Cohen, who'll be coming that way. You should get to know him. I said, I already met him. You know, hook me up. Mm. So I got to talk to Bill about what was going on here in Washington. And I think I convinced my producers that I had some depth on the subject of Watergate. Bill was married at the time. I was single, so it was really a platonic relationship. And then I read in the New York Times that he and his wife had gotten divorced just about the time I married Dr. Kistner. Mm. I was married to Dr. Kistner, who was the co-developer of the oral contraceptive. Well, another 12 years happened, and my husband died, and it was in the New York Times, and Bill called me, and he said, I'm very sorry. And we started talking again, and then it hooked up. And it reminded me of what my mother taught me. Don't go with first sight love. Get to be friends first. And I thought, how boring. But it worked. We've been married for 21 years. And we had to go through that miry clay, as it were, to get to where we are now.
And there was some controversy as you guys were dating and getting married. And it was because of... your skin
color. The fact
color.
That we're interracial. Yes. That's curious that you say that, Steve.
Well, I've heard you talk about it, and I've heard him talk about it.
There was controversy for him. Mm-hmm. Whites generally are the ones that have the problem when someone they love marry blacks. We blacks don't generally have that same kind of problem. But I have to say, Bill's mother and father, he thought his father was a bigot. One day I overheard him talking to his father, heard his father's voice on the phone one Sunday. And I said, Bill, you don't know your father at all. He's not a bigot. He won't have a problem with me. We met. We got along. I love his father. I was there when his mother passed. It's sad to talk about them now in that context. But the controversy was more the country, what the country would think. Because in 1967, we had a Supreme Court decision, Loving versus Virginia, that said blacks and whites could not marry, could not be seen in public together. And both Bill and I were of age at the time of 1967. Bill would have been 27, I would have been 26. So we were adults when that kind of thing existed. But I have to say, we got married in the Capitol. I wanted to get married in the Capitol because that's where Bill had served. And I wanted to get married there because my people built that building. That building was built by slaves. And we had had an anti-miscegenation law in this country. So that's my race woman thing coming out. I wanted to do it there. And Strom Thurmond was at our wedding.
Oh, so this was 1996?
Oh, who's counting? The one who knows. Valentine's Day, 1996.
Okay. I want to play a quick soundbite. This is clip number 4, Katiana, which is you and your husband on Charlie Rose Show in 2007 talking about a question that was asked of then-Senator Cohen right after your marriage.
Okay, what is it?
Well, tell Charlie about the U.S. senator that asked you that question.
Was this a question as to
You know the question.
Well, basically, he asked me which one of Janet's parents was white. I said, neither one. Why do you ask? Well, she's so intelligent. Yeah. And I don't think that he realized what he was saying at the time, but it did express a sentiment that of racial superiority, that if you're white, you're smarter. If you're black, you're not.
And if you're smart, it had something to do with your white lineage.
Yeah.
That when I heard that story, it struck me, just because that happened in 1996 or 97, mm-hmm. and there were people still thinking that way. First of all, can you tell us the name of that senator?
He's now deceased.
So you can tell us.
He was a northern senator.
Oh, interesting.
I won't tell because he didn't mean any harm. You have to, well, you probably do understand. You're being white. You have a better understanding of how you're cultivated about the other, about race. I mean, this is America. Let's face it. We talk about race all the time. Whites want to say blacks talk about it because they see us on television complaining about unarmed black men being shot by police with impunity. But whites talk about it, too. I wrote an article on implicit bias for the Law Journal. You grow up thinking you're superior. Everybody drinks the Kool-Aid. Blacks think to some extent that the problems they have are their own fault, the ones who are not enlightened. So they believe they're inferior. Whites think they're superior. So when they see someone like an Obama or an Oprah or someone like me, they can't accept that what I have isn't something that was taken from them. It's the epitome of entitlement based on white superiority or white privilege. So when you're conditioned in those concepts, it's very easy to think, oh, she's smart. Because I don't think of black people as being smart. They don't remember that they denied us the right to learn to read and write. But when you see someone who's broken through that, it's hard to accept these two realities. So rather than accepting me as who I am, they would rather change me and make me something else. I had an elder white man when I was having dinner one night with the Reagans. He meant well. We were talking about horses and our love for horses. And he said, what island are you from? And I thought, well, I was living in New York at the time, so I said, Manhattan. But I had to be from an island. He couldn't accept that I was a black person, probably from Kentucky or Indiana. I had to be from someplace exotic in his mind. So he had to change me rather than changing his own mind.
We're going to go to break here. But before we go to break, I want to set our next segment up with a couple of questions for you to ponder during the break. One is about a speech, and Dr. Martin Luther King gave many speeches that are very famous. One that has always rung in my mind is an excerpt from one of his speeches in which he said to white Southerners, or to blacks, actually, remember, white Southerners are being fed Jim Crow because they're poor, and it's the one way that they can feel better and more empowered than Negroes, the term at the time. I want to talk to you about that a little bit, that sentiment. And also, polling data now that suggests it's more controversial in an American family for a daughter or son to bring home someone from the opposing political party than the opposing race. I want you to think about those two things. We'll talk about both subjects on the other side of this break. Janet Langhart-Cohen is our very special guest here at the Takeout Podcast, which I know you are digging nearly as much as I am.
You are listening to The Takeout.
And living every moment of it, we're at Old Ebbitt Grill just across from the Treasury Department and the White House, because the Treasury Department's right next to the White House. As you well know, I spend a lot of time at the White House, so Old Ebbitt is a very convenient place for me to do this podcast. That's one of the reasons we're here. It's also a great restaurant. The food has arrived. Oysters on the half shell for Janet.
Oysters on the half shell. Makes me think of Boston.
There you go. You're the first person who has ordered oysters on the half shell on the 32nd episode.
No guys have
part.
Ever no. ordered oysters.
They probably should have. Just saying. Steve Shigaris is with me, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. Janet, I left you with two really easy questions to ponder before we went to break. A speech that Martin Luther King gave to blacks in the South at the time, talking about segregation, Jim Crow saying, remember, this is the bitter meal that the politicians of the South deliver poor whites, because their life, meaning poor whites in the South, is terrible.
don't think it isn't. It's just marginally better than ours, and segregation is the way in which they politically survive by telling whites they're superior to blacks. Don't ever forget that. Mm-hmm. Question one to ponder. And two, polling data recently in America Now suggests it is more controversial, more upsetting in American family for a son or daughter to bring someone home that they are dating from an opposing party than an opposing race.
Can I take that last question first?
Sure.
Because it's more current.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Who are they polling? Are they polling whites? Because it's all about culture and mm-hmm. race identity.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they polling to get these answers?
Well, the national survey, so I imagine it's a representative sample of the country, which means it's more white than not,
mm-hmm.
by definition, still.
I find that most groups, I think I may have mentioned on the end that I'm reading this book, Homo Deus, by Harari, who talks about one of the segments in the books. He talks about chimps and how chimps, you know, we're related to chimps whether we like it or not. Chimps in their grouping, they're very discriminating. And anyone outside their group, even if they look like them, if they're from another few distance away, they're not allowed in and they'll fight to the death. That kind of reminds me of the identity politics that we're practicing here in the 21st century. Mostly whites, because they're the dominant group, have issues with anybody mixing with them. As I may have mentioned on the anti-miscegenation laws, we had to go to the Supreme Court. People like me who are multiracial are called hybrids, bastard, like John Bastard The Stones, what is the show called? The show about the Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Every time they say John Bastard, I think of what my people were called by whites and blacks because we were a mixed race. I think that whites have difficulty with anything that's different from their own. Because we blacks have been mixing with whites all along and accepted the mixed part of our races, we don't have a problem with that. To the degree. Now, some black women will say they get mad when they see a black man with a white woman, and some black men get mad when they see me with my husband. But it's all about power. Who has the power to act on how they feel? And whites have the power to act on how they feel.
But this poll suggests that partisanship has now overtaken that. Do you believe that?
I don't know. I'm not scientific on that. I think it all boils down to race, and because this administration has been so racist from the very beginning of attacking Mexicans who are brown, Muslims who are not so white, and law and order, which is talking about blacks, it's really, I think, about race at the very bottom, the ideology. I thought I had it figured out that maybe the more enlightened of whites had arrived until 53% of white women, educated and not so educated, voted for Trump. I lost all ideas of trying to figure out this society. So maybe my answer isn't as profound as I'd like it to be. But religion is one thing, politics is another. But the most profound is race. Did I answer your question?
Sure. Yeah. And what about the history of segregation in the South and the point that Martin Luther King was trying to make in that time mm-hmm. to blacks about poor whites and what segregation meant to them as a cultural dividing line that allowed politicians to get away with things that were not very responsive to poor whites either?
Well, the well-to-do whites, the ruling class of whites, they have always weaponized fear and division. It goes back to the old adage, divide and conquer. They have given poor whites this feeling that at least you're not black. You may not have health care. You may not have dental care. You may not have education, but you're white. And they bought that, and they see that their whiteness doesn't pay their bills, doesn't give them health care. So what do? Rather than getting angry at the ruling class and the politicians, they are weaponized to be mad at the blacks. There's a saying that a woman in Boston gave me. She said, Janet, a lot of black people are proud of you because you're the first black to do this, but a lot of them are jealous. And there's some plantation thinking that when Miss Ann comes to give her old dresses out to the slave girls. Miss Anne is a size 9. The slave girls are 12, 14, 18. The little scrawny slave can wear the dresses. Instead of the slaves getting mad at Miss Anne for not having enough dresses for everybody in the right sizes, they get mad at the one who the dresses fits and they rip it off her. And that is the mentality, I think, coming back to Homo Deus. It's easy to weaponize people based on difference, to dehumanize people, to make other people feel privileged, even when they have no legitimate reason for feeling privileged. I wish I could get a poor white woman from Appalachia on welfare and get her to talk to an urban black woman on welfare, and they would see that they have more in common, which is what my play, Anonema, talks about, the commonalities between disparate peoples. And if we could see our commonalities, the rulers, I mean, we go to jail. The rulers go to bank. So if they could just wake up and see, why would you be mad at a black person if you don't have anything? Why wouldn't you be mad at the white people who control everything, who disperses everything, who makes the rules? Why? Does that make sense?
Steve, help us get to Anne and Emmett in a conversation about that.
Well, I do want to ask one quick question, though, about you mentioned that you feel that the Trump administration is racist. This president, do you think he's racist? Do you think it starts at the top?
You can only measure what people say and their behavior. I can't get inside his head. I met Donald Trump, and I didn't get the feeling. This is nearly 30 years ago. I didn't get the feeling that he was a racist. Now, a lot of racists can be polite to black people, but I just didn't get that feeling. His tactics, his policies are racist and discriminatory. The fact that he wants to, the way he's dealing with people of a different orientation, the way he's dealing with immigrants when his parents or grandparents were immigrants, the way he's dealt with women. What's curious about white males historically is that they have given white women the power to point their finger and have a black man executed, but wouldn't give a white woman the right to vote. So you got it. It's all very complex. It's divisive. It's controlling. And race is so easy in this country. That's the tool, that's the weapon that is so easy to use. When I walk into a retail store, I'm followed.
Still?
I'm followed. I have a tactic. When I have time and I notice they're following me, I reverse it and start following them. But I'm judged.
How does that work out?
They'd go away. I just start looking at the same things they're looking at, the way they were on my shoulder looking at everything.
Letting them know you understand what the deal is.
Just reversing the behavior. That's all. But you talked about Martin and the speech he made in the South. The white Southerners historically have not minded how close black people get to them, because we nurtured their babies. Mm-hmm. You know, we had mammies to suckle their babies, and they slept with us. This is why I'm the color I am now. They just care how high you get. Northerners don't care how high you get, just don't get close. So it's a very different.
And you've experienced that reality.
Mm-hmm. Southern white people, one-on-one.
Proximity is okay. Place is different.
Don't get higher. Don't get uppity.
And north place is okay,
north,
but proximity
just
is different.
Just don't want to have anything to do with it. And that's when the weaponization happens, when the politicians are ready to. Politicians aren't the only one. Religious leaders can also be guilty of this.
And be reluctant.
And that's what Martin spoke to. He spoke to the religious leaders when he was in the Birmingham jail. He asked the clergy, the cloth, all men and women of the cloth, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, he asked them all, come stand with me. This is your moral moment. The only ones who came with him, the black Protestants and churchmen, said, no, don't start trouble. Leave it alone. Leave it alone. It was Rabbi Abraham Heschel who came and supported him. So it's really very complex, this American experiment.
When we introduced you, I mentioned that you're a playwright. And this play, Anne and Emmett, Anne Frank, Emmett Till. Tell us how that came about.
Oh, I was at a luncheon. I had just written my book, From Rage to Reason, My Life in Two Americas. And I was at this wonderful luncheon, and I was among friends. And this one friend of mine came up, white friend of mine. I've known her for a long time. And she said, Jenna, what is this rage you're talking about? And I said, being black in America. And so she said, what are the two Americas? And I said, the America of my youth, apartheid America, and the America of now, promise. And she said, Janet, you're married to Bill Cohen. You're very successful. Why do you want to bring all that up again? It would be unbecoming of you to play the victim. And I wanted to say, I'm not a victim. I'm a survivor. But then I remembered what that word survivor meant to her and her people. And I didn't say it because it would sound flippant. So I held my tongue because I didn't want to be a skunk at the party. But I went home, and I said to Bill, I said, imagine she's telling me I should forget my history. It'd be unbecoming to remember 300 years of slavery, lynching, a friend assassinated, a cousin lynched. It's unbecoming because I slipped through the crack of racist America. How dare she? And so Bill said, I think he wanted to get me out of his hair because I was raging. He said, write something. So I thought about Anne Frank. What would she have said to Emmett Till? She would have understood. Two teen martyrs who lived in societies, children who lived in societies that couldn't protect them. And so then I started thinking about it because I had them segregated in my mind because I grew up in a segregated world. I never thought of Anne Frank and Emmett Till together. But I had just closed her diary when I opened Jet magazine and saw that picture of Emmett Till.
Mm-hmm. So, folks, if you are not familiar with the story of Emmett Till, I urge you to look it up. Emmett Till's murder in Mississippi was one of the galvanizing moments for the civil rights movement in our country. It is memorialized in pop culture in 100 different ways, books, plays, music. It is the catalyzing moment that set in motion Rosa Parks. Many in the civil rights movement look back at that particular murder and say that was the moment in which all of the consciousness, white and black, converged and changed. Anne Frank, of course, is someone well known and well established. Her book, The Diary of Anne Frank, translated in 67 different languages. Someone who grew up in Germany in Frankfurt. Her parents moved to Amsterdam. It was occupied by the Nazis. She was in a safe house, as it were, for 2 years. Died at Bergen-Belsen of typhus at a concentration camp. But her diary is a vivid portrayal of a child living in a world of darkness and still holding out some hope for humanity. How in your mind did these two converse?
I'm almost to tears listening to you recount that history. Emmett Till was the young 14-year-old boy from Chicago who went to the South in the summer, as many blacks we often did because we came from the South, to visit our relatives. And he was in Money, Mississippi, and he made the mistake of not understanding the Southern mores where blacks were concerned. And he whistled at a white woman, and he was brutally murdered because of it. Later years, I interviewed Rosa Parks, and I asked her, what was she thinking sitting on that bus? And she told me she was thinking about Emmett Till, because he was murdered in 54, the Montgomery bus boycotts, and her sitting there that December was 1955. When I opened the magazine at 14 years old, because I'm the same age as Emmett Till, I remember the darkness falling over that summer before we went back to school. And the people in my neighborhood, my elders, were dark because they knew that that could happen to any one of us. Because if they murdered him because he was black, the only difference between Emmett is that he was there and we weren't. And you see police killing blacks, unarmed blacks now, with no justice. Well, this was 1955. We couldn't even speak up about it. So my family was hurt, angry, fearful, and the worst thing of all, they were helpless. There was no justice. And I had just closed Anne's diary, reading about man's inhumanity to man, and thinking they were both the same age. The tactics that each of their oppressors used was the same. They were segregated and lived in ghettos. The Jewish people had to wear yellow patches to identify them from the other whites. Blacks here didn't have to wear patches. Pigmentation was enough. Jews couldn't be seen outside after dark. We had sundowner rules here for blacks in many of the cities, many of the northern cities. The Jewish people had to sit up in the balcony at cinemas. We blacks had to sit up in the balcony of theaters here in my youth, called the Crow's Nest. It was so many similarities, and I wonder why had I not, since I discovered them both at the same time, why had I not ever put them together? And it took a Jewish friend of mine to say that, because I'd heard whites say that to me, oh, get over it, oh, stop talking about it, even in quarter-hour busing days in Boston. Oh, don't talk about that black stuff. It was black stuff when whites were stoning black children. It wasn't white stuff. When you look at Charlottesville with those neo-Nazis attacking the anti-fascist, it wasn't called white-on-white crime. When whites are ODing on opiates, they have a health bill. When we ODed on crack and cocaine, it was called a crime bill. So we have to look at these disparities, and I looked at those disparities in my play, Anne and Emmett. And one of the things Anne says to Emmett, it's against the law in Europe to say the Holocaust didn't exist, to expose the swastika, to try to have a march that's pro-Nazi. In this country, you get a police escort if you want to talk. It's called free speech. And I often think, if I were Jewish, how would I feel? How would I reconcile not being able to do those things in Europe after the atrocities that happened, or live here in a free country where you can say horrible things about Jews and blacks? And even the president of the United States in the 21st century, realizing, if he has ever studied history, the history of this country and the war that our two peoples fought, North and South, and the Nazi war, and he equates that with...
Finish your thought.
The reason I'm laughing is the waiter just brought a beautiful piece of chocolate cake. Is that for me? Is it my birthday?
No, it's just happy birthday, Major. I don't know who that is or why it's here. But
happy birthday.
Yes, on Thursday, which will be later this week.
What is the date of Thursday?
August 24th.
My husband's the 28th.
There you go.
Well, happy birthday.
Happy Secretary birthday Cole. To both
Virgo,
of us.
Virgo.
Virgo Leo. He's born of the Virgo Leo
cusp.
You want
to be a Leo,
yes.
I can tell you.
Very painful to be born on a cusp. Let me tell you that, folks. Listen, Janet Langhart-Cohen, thank you so much for being with us.
It's
You've been a fantastic
pleasure.
Guest.
Thank you.
Old
thank
Epic
you.
Grill has been our most hospitable and warm and delicious host. We are so grateful to have been here with them. And happy birthday, Major. I will take the chocolate cake and the candle. We'll blow that out at some point in the future.
Make a wish. Make a wish.
CBSN viewers, you're not going to be able to see it. Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Major.
And don't forget, the Takeout Outtake Especial is next on CBSN and on Tuesday in Podcast World. This has been The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Tatiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.